options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome back. This is our last one, so thank you for spending as much time as you have for the last 3 days if you've gutted that out. If you've been listening to the replays, we appreciate that as well. Today, we've had plenty of discussion over the course of the last 3 days on commodities, but today I led off with commodities with, of course, Mackenzie Davis at Sailing Stone, and we'll close with two hitters on commodities. It's Josh Crum, of course, is no stranger to the summit. I think Josh might be in the top five appearances people for HedgEye TV and Real Conversations. A lot of that comes because of your feedback. You know, when we get really thoughtful people that have their own framework and process, that's really what we try to double down on, triple down on. But Jeff Curry, welcome. It's the first time. I know you guys, I think you guys used to work together at Goldman. Yep. Now you're the band is back. ABAX, of course, Josh is the founder of ABAX, and it looks like obviously Jeff and him are comfortable being on the same camera together. So welcome, Jeff. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks. Good to be back. I've been on the show a lot, and I think my signature is ugly curtains. So more ugly curtains. Happy to run anchor here and hopefully not drop the baton. So
yeah, that's and Jeff, can you talk to us about your new jersey? It's a jersey that I used to wear, the Carlisle jersey.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Yeah.
I think the best way to describe it is, I wanted to be in the investment opportunities surrounding energy transition as opposed to talking about it in my role at Goldman, and you couldn't find a better place than Carlisle to be able to do that, to have a seat at the table and be a part of the discussion in the energy transition. It's the perfect platform, iconic franchise and, the leaders in private equity. And then also when you look at the energy franchise here at Carlisle, it's bar none, best returns out there, and as a great group of investors to be tied with. So I'm super excited about the opportunity, and I hope I can lay out the reasons why I'm so enthusiastic about, the energy transition opportunity. So,
yeah, you're like in hockey. I don't know if you're a hockey fan, Jeff, but you're like in hockey, you're like Patrick Kane. He's like he's no longer playing for the Blackhawks after crushing it forever there, and now he's got a new jersey. So with, of course, the Detroit Red Wings. But let's just maybe start with that. I had Mackenzie Davis, who I'm sure you both know. If you don't, you guys should obviously know each other. But he, I said, there's a real important platform point here to start to launch from, which is define energy transition. I mean, we have some pretty loose definitions. We have some crazy definitions, at least according to me. And then we have the practical ones. And you guys are practical guys. So maybe whoever wants to take a crack at that, maybe Jeff.
All right. I think there's three terms I want to talk about here. Energy transition, energy additions, and energy pathways. Because pathways is, I think, what you're referring to as transition. So before this time, every other shift in energy was an energy addition. We're consuming the same amount of wood today as we did in 1820 when we transitioned to or additioned to coal. And then we additioned oil on top of coal, and then gas and nuclear on top of the other energy sources, and then renewables on top of that. What we're proposing here, which we haven't even started, is to take out transition out of the hydrocarbons and into these other energy sources that are unemitted. This is something like we've never done before. Mm-hmm. Now, when we think about that's what we think about with transition. But the other point here I want to emphasize is by definition, this is going to be a very disorderly process. And by just focusing on the green side, you're missing those pathways that need to be generated between the brown and the green. And so when we think about the word energy pathways, what we're talking about is that pathway between the brown and the green. And we don't know that. I like to point out, you go back to the 1970s when we were dealing with the war on acid rain. Did anybody ever think that if you put platinum and palladium in the back of your tailpipe, that you were going to be reducing the aerosols that were creating the problems around acid rain? No, you had to try many different pathways until you finally found that. And I think that's the part that's missing. We're jumping to the end and thinking we found all these technologies, they're going to work. These technologies are running into real serious bottlenecks and other issues that are associated with it. And I don't think we completely know or understand what that pathway is going to look like.
Well, that isn't part of the problem. And I know Josh has strong opinions on this, but isn't part of the problem, like in particular with ESG, is that that's the point. You want this outcome and you don't really have any clue what that pathway or the pathways are going to look like. But that's your outcome. That's your preferred outcome. And therefore, I mean, actually, Vivek, yesterday, Ramaswamy said, look, that's a man-made problem with a man-made solution. What do you think about that, Josh?
Oh, it's 100% a man-made problem with a man-made solution. But I think there's an important point here. We know what to do. With Econ 101, and everybody listening to this has taken a negative externality. You impose a tax on it. Now, the reason why the tax is so important is that it's technologically agnostic. Think about it, that's your stick. Then there's carrots, the subsidies. What is IRA? It's a carrot. And so it's picking and choosing those technologies without letting the market do it. And so the war on acid rain was a smashing success. Do we talk about acid rain anymore? No, because we created a price for sulfur, tax sulfur, and we have finally eradicated all the sulfur and aerosols out of the atmosphere. And, we're left with an environment that no longer faces many of those types of problems. So we know it works. But I think the key point here is that policymakers were aggressive about taking Econ 101, applying a price around sulfur. That created a lot of innovation, stimulated, VCs getting involved in everything. There was, you see an explosion of patents around desulfurization once the taxes and prices went into place. And then we solved it rather quickly. Now, I'm not going to say that, carbon is as easy as sulfur. However, the part that's missing here is that we're not addressing a market failure with the tools we know what to do. Going back to a man-made problem with a man-made solution. We know what the solution is. We aren't doing it because the politics of passing a carbon price or carbon tax are extraordinarily difficult. And so we're hamstrung. So we've taken a market failure and have now turned it into a government failure. And then the market responses to that government failure have actually made the market failure worse than what we even started with. So, we know what to do. We're just not doing it.
Yeah. Josh, tee off, man.
Yeah, look, I think the key word that Jeff said over and over and over again is market. I would say one of the problems that I've seen, I actually just went back and looked when I was last on Hedgeye, and it was actually, the fall of 2021. So this was before Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, which is, again, getting blamed for everything. But if you listen to that interview, everything was very predictable with what was going to happen in this energy capex cycle, because we're just, so underinvested. And I would say another piece to this whole dynamic, I just came away from I just left Luzon and the FT Commodities Summit with all of the major Swiss commodity trading houses, which, by the way, just one stat that I think is just so important to understand when we're talking about commodity markets and capital allocation, is these companies collectively made $100 billion in commodity trading last year. That's up from about similar last year. And that's up from about, 30 or 40 billion annually before that. So there are, massive investment opportunities and vast ability to make profits in the cycle But we have not seen the public markets and the public capital markets making similar types of returns or similar types of investments. So I think it's a dynamic I want to talk through a little bit. But anyways, you know, the key point and the key takeaway that I had from that conference again is just how focused or how important the wartime economy is becoming to all the conversations. You had a one of the keynote presentations was a very senior official in the in the U.S. administration, and said in probably the most clear terms, we are trying to make sure that Russia's LNG is dead in the water. So again, very, very, the commodity supply chain is really talking about, not just energy transition, but also just completely diverging, in sort of a wartime, like way. So, those are really the themes that we're driving commodities, and it's just going to make this whole thing even more complicated.
Yeah, I think you've been very clear, indeed crystal clear over the years on how you think about, the base of the cost curve, energy's importance, how you can't have anything else embedded in an expectation of the price unless you start with that. I think underinvestment in supply, I think a lot of people, talk about that. But that last one, the secure supply, geopolitical debate on who should have, like that Russian LNG example is perfect. This is like who tells you guys that they know how that's going to play out?
Yeah, well, it's that sort of the trilemma of security, reliability, and price, right? And I would say price and reliability. We focused very much on green for a while when we had excess capacity. But now we're in a position where we don't have the same kind of access to capacity. And so we're trying to solve multiple variables at once, which, again, is quite different, difficult. Jeff probably, has some good ways to think about this as well.
Shoot, Jeff.
Well, I just want to point out, not only are we struggling with energy security coming off of the back of the Ukrainian invasion, but we also have now introduced AI to it. And I like to point out, AI is all chips and copper. It's chips that, here's a stat for you. Your NVIDIA GPU, your graphic processing unit, consumes as much as one average American household. That's
really
a lot. So not only are we dealing with these security issues, we've now just introduced an explosive demand dynamic on top of that. You're already starting to see it beginning to accelerate. These data centers, I think I saw it earlier, they're energy pigs, but they're the size of elephants. I think we have now really compounded the problem. It goes back to my point. Why is this the most investable space out there, even against AI? Because you're not doing AI until you debottleneck the energy system. And because it's all electricity, you want to go back to the real core bottleneck, it's copper.
Yeah.
That's why I'm a huge bull on copper, and I think it's going to be the best performing commodity unlike anybody's ever seen before, is because you have a demand that's unsatiated. It's almost perfectly price insensitive. I don't see it stopping anytime in the near future. And so, you have all these bottlenecks on even the AI. At the same time, you have these energy security issues.
Yeah, copper is a top three position for me. So I'm very interested in people like giving me multifaceted narratives on copper. But I think it's pretty simple, right? I mean, you just nailed it. It's not that complicated. If you're of the electrification view, the AI view, the whatever, rainbows and puppy dog view, you can't do it without copper. I think that's a very simple point that we have a broad audience here can take away from that.
By the way, I'm going to make a point here because people are going to go, Curry, you've been talking about that story since March of 21, and it is now April of 24. For 3 years, it hasn't worked. I want to point out, we were telling the same story in 06 around corn and ethanol. Meaning you're going to blow the top off corn. And by the way, it didn't work. Finally, in 2011 and 12, it just went straight up.
Yeah, why does it, Josh, why would, I always make the, it's not a joke, it's just a chart. I mean, Coco is better than AI. I mean, the chart of Coco is absolutely vertical and unrelentingly so. Copper looks like, you know, just in terms of the signal, it's fractal dimension is clear. It looks like Jeff's going to be right. Why wouldn't it have already done it? Like, just give me kind of like your two cents on that.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I think I've presented this framework a few times, but I mean, what's quite important is, when you look at price, you're looking at just one part of the curve, right? You're typically looking at the 3-month price. In fact, in copper right now, we've got one of the steepest, contangos of the cash to 3-month price. So sort of the premium for 3-month over the spot market, is showing that we do have some inventory there, but it's really running. So again, commodities as being spot assets really can't anticipate the future the same way that equities or other assets can. So the rising price is a process. It's not a straight line like an equity. Where you own when you own the raw materials in the front month prices, right? So the supply and demand gets rationed by rising volatility, mm-hmm. not just rising price.
Right.
And so over the cycle, you see these periods of consolidation and debottlenecking, and then you get to another leg of rising price and rising volatility, which is, I think, is exactly what we're in now.
Well, I mean, it didn't take long for gold to do that. We can do that next. But I mean, copper's got, again, it's like all the same attributes before it finally just ripped, and it just doesn't stop. I mean, and to your point, the volatility is going up as the price is going up, which is precisely the point.
I want to go back on the, one of the big drivers of why copper has been a dud really has to do with what was going on in the Chinese property market. And when we think about commodities more broadly, why are they rallying now? Is that 22 and 23 were a consolidation period for the global economy. Mid-cycle pause for the West. Standard high rates, high energy created the need to consolidate around that. We're coming out of it. You're at the bottom of the IP. They're beginning to rebound. What went on in China? They are replacing that property driver of economic growth with manufacturing. Everything from EVs, batteries, solar panels. And that process has been shifted. Mm-hmm. And so that weakness as you transitioned out of property and into manufacturing created a drag on copper. The reason why copper, oil, commodities are all beginning to go up is we're seeing global synchronous increases in economic activity for the first time since around 21, late 21 and maybe early 22 before the Ukrainian invasion. And so I think that's one of the big drivers here that is changing. Now, this time when we're doing it, which brings it into your gold discussion, we're doing it on top of substantially increased macro tail risk, which is what gold is currently trying to price, right? Mm-hmm. Now, whether it's inflationary risk or if it's what's going on with geopolitical risk, whether if it's in Iran and Israel or, even Venezuela and Guyana, Russia, and the rest of, the emerging markets. But I think the key point here is we have global synchronous expansionary activity overlaid on incredibly, potentially explosive macro tail risks.
Yeah, that, guys, if you show slide 55, I think, I call them the macro unaware, like people who didn't, there have been rolling recessions and big things in this world, that started really slowing in 2022. And if you just look at a very basic thing that most people should be macro aware of, which is global manufacturing PMI, That thing went from the moon in 2021 to bright red and pervasively so. And literally, we're just in the first month of a, technical expansion, right, Jeff? So I think that when you're looking for big things, if you're elk hunting, like I like to do, I like to find something that goes from bearish to bullish on the cycle. The slide before that, guys, is how we show that sine curve. If you could, you would, right, Josh? You just buy the bottom of every cycle and you sell the top and you'd be like Bernie Madoff.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, the other thing that we're running into that we saw a little bit actually back when I worked with Jeff, in sort of, 2010, 2011, after the massive Chinese stimulus, coming out of the financial crisis, is we kept running into these rolling recessions in the same way. And ultimately, it was because we were capacity constrained on infrastructure, particularly in raw materials and commodities. The price call that I made when I worked with Jeff of $5 copper or $11,000 copper, just before we hit the peak the first time, I think it had never been over $375 at that point when we forecast that was going to go blow away through that, and it was because there was a sort of a supply side lag to what that stimulus was. So we were capacity constrained and probably running on the supply side too conservative. And then that happened over and over. Where we kept running into these sort of mini recessions, every time that the price and volatility spiked on commodities.
Yeah, it's an extremely important point from a long-term cycle perspective to know where you are. Like we are here. I just when I think about it too, I mean that's a much more like a positive. Like they're positives and negative catalysts. They're catalysts that are all positive, but some can be negative, like geopolitical risk. That would be okay. We're going to have World War III. And then we have positives, like we're coming out of a global industrial manufacturing recession. Another big positive that I don't hear people talk a lot about, Jeff, is India. I mean, India, you could say if you're being completely discretionary and qualitative macro, you'd say, gold's ripping and cocoa's ripping because India's got 8% GDP and they love chocolate and gold.
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
No, unfortunately, with the cocoa and the rest of them, this is a supply shock. It's El Nino. These things all sit on the equatorial belt. Coffee, cocoa, sugar, all of these are they're under a very different dynamic with the supply uncertainties. I think cocoa, as you pointed out, shames NVIDIA, which shows you the non-linearities that these markets can hit when you get into that dynamic. And if anything, with sugar in there, it kind of hurts India. But I think, before I go into India, I want to quickly talk about gold because there is a big question mark there.
Yeah.
All of our standard metrics for valuing gold don't work right now. Gold is going up in the context of rising real rates as well as a strong dollar.
Yep.
That doesn't happen. By the way, the only other time that happened was the 1970s. What else do we know about it? A very large, mysterious buyer operating through the OTC markets who is price insensitive. What does that tell you historically? Usually it's a big emerging market, central bank. Could it be China? Could it be India? We don't know. We'll find out after the fact. But I think what it shows you is that the pricing of gold has shifted. It's pricing different dynamics, inflationary risk or geopolitical risk. But going back to India, I think you're spot on. That India is the bright spot in the global economy right now in terms of an area that can be generating outsized growth that can help propel many of these commodities higher. I'm not going to say it's going to be a repeat of China back in the 2000s, but I think, as you point out, it's a very positive driver for commodities, particularly markets like oil and copper.
Yeah, it's. I was obviously joking on the discretionary macro comment. I just want to make sure you guys are still we're still playing ball here. But for example, a guy we just hired. He's Indian born. He's U.S. college educated. Name's Raj. Sits across from me, and he just got back from. He doesn't go home a lot, and. The dynamics of Modi and what that country has actually become in fairly short order post the pandemic is a tangible thing that most people miss. I mean, it is, as you guys know, not normal for an economy to go from 6%, which was the highest in the G20 on a real basis, to 8 and stay there. So I just, it's just something that I generally see kind of macro unaware investors completely miss. But back to the gold point and now silver. Do you guys see that like mystery buyer on silver? The thing hasn't had a down day either since gold took off, more specifically.
Yeah. So you know, back to Jeff's point of how it's broken out. So actually, I was talking to Stefan Wheeler, who, of course, has been on the show as well before, about our gold price model. And I totally agree with Jeff. You know, on a month over month, you know, the metrics, the drivers of the rate of change have been trending well. In line with what's predicted, but we're probably $200 to $300 over what the model on levels would suggest. And you know, kind of doing some of my channel checks. Another interesting thing that's happening in the gold market is we've lost some of that transparency of who that big buyer is. Like a lot of times, that would have come through the major bullion banks in London. You know, and generally some macro funds would know kind of what's going on. It does look like more and more of the flows are going through Dubai. And that a lot of the big premiums are coming is from Dubai, and just, you know, with really very little visibility. But then the one other big buyer, we've actually not seen it in the coin market, which kind of gets to your point on silver. You know, a lot of times you would see you know, premiums and shortages in sort of the blanks and the coin dealer supply chains when these moves are happening. We're not really seeing that in the West. We're not seeing the traditional retail buyers of gold and silver, and that's another reason why silver. I mean, silver obviously has a whole another industrial story. But on the pure precious metal speculative story, we're not seeing it. But you know, we are seeing a lot more just pure gold buying at any price and premium through Dubai, and not seeing the same flows we usually see in London.
Yeah, anytime my signal sees that, I mean, as you know, Josh, I have a daily risk range and it's dynamically readjusting for volatility, and it is rare. By the way, especially when you tack on what Jeff said, dollar up, rates up, and vol for gold up, like that again, I didn't actually know that didn't happen since the 1970s, but I'll take Jeff's word for it. And it's a really interesting and powerful thing. I mean, you could wake up tomorrow and gold could be at 2,227, and it just had a minor correction, but it doesn't correct. And it's a really important thing. I don't know if you're still at Goldman, Jeff, if you could get us the name of who's buying that.
By the way, I still talk to them. They don't know.
That's nuts, man. Like, but there's a lot of nutty things going on if you have absolutely no global macro lens. I mean, the amount of just to your point there, Josh. I mean, the amount of serious business people around here that I'm close to that are doing serious business across every industry, the amount of PJs that are flying back and forth between Dubai is at a new high. Right? We have a lot going on. And if you believe that the oil price is sustainable, then you believe that they're going to have a lot of money to buy a lot of things, and gold's one of them. So
it's... Yeah, and I'd also see the market structure has shifted very much east, right? You know, one of the big problems
east?
With...
Yeah, the gold market?
One of the problems with the London bullion market is we've lost a lot of access from broader market participants. There's only a couple bullion banks that are really active in that market. And so, you know, even at ABEX, you know, we'll, you know, later, you know, we will be launching a, you know, an Asian-based gold pool and futures market off of Kilo Bars, because we think that's a lot that's touching where the growth in emerging market wealth is really coming from for the physical gold market. So, you know, we've been investing in that market, moving east away from sort of the London and COMEX markets, which I think it'll continue to do. But even, you know, one other very interesting point on the gold market is really the retail you know, jewelry demand from younger generations in China.
Yeah.
That we haven't seen in a long time. You know, there were stories, you know, 4 years ago about how, you know, millennials in China, you know, no longer buy jewelry. But that's just definitely, I think Chow Tai Fook, I haven't seen their Q1 numbers, but, you know, Q4, and this is one of the largest jewelers in Hong Kong and China. You know, I think they had, you know, their Q4 numbers were up 30 or 40%. So there's broad base. It's not just central banks. There's a broad base emerging market demand for gold. And obviously China is a big part of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many silly things that people say that are one-dimensional, like all they do is crypto, for example, not that we were going to go there, but we are. And, you know, there's so many, like, one-dimensional views that it really takes away. And that's kind of, unfortunately, the political reality of this country, too. People don't want to talk to other people about other views. But, I mean, you don't have to have a view, like the Peter Schiff view, that it's just gold instead of Bitcoin, or it's just Bitcoin instead of gold. I think, like, Indian demand, Chinese demand, et cetera, et cetera. You just rattled off plenty. Has to be part of the discussion. Do you still deal with that, Jeff or Josh, like that whole Bitcoin versus gold bullshit?
I think they're quite different commodities for different things. I've kind of stuck with that for a long time. They're typically
stuck with it.
It's
like, why did we have to bear this cross? Like who gave us that? Like, why do we have to do this?
Yeah. Look, I mean, gold's move, that 25, 30% move in gold, this is, you're talking $2-3 trillion in money stock move, right? Which is, large, and that's what's happened in the last quarter, basically. And that's the entire market cap of Bitcoin. So I don't really see them necessarily competing. Now there's, I do think there's a bigger problem, and this is, I do think there's a lot more speculative sort of gambling type activity that you particularly see in younger generations. I know I'm not saying it's necessarily new, but there is definitely a lot of new tools, and that whole particularly the altcoin and DeFi markets are in my view almost all gambling. Like we haven't shown a lot of utility in any of these protocols at this point.
Okay. And did you want to add to anything on Bitcoin there, Jeff?
No, I don't think people view them as substitutes. They're very different plays. And when you throw in, Ethereum and rest of the crypto space in there, their functionality is radically different than what gold is. And so, that was a debate of, let's say 2020 and 2021. In 2024, and I think as Josh pointed out, the magnitude and the dollars flowing into gold are now larger than what's going into the crypto space. Because a lot of that, massive run-up is you put $500 billion into crypto, it's going to go a lot further than $500 billion put into gold. But I think, that debate is something of the past. It's not something of today.
Yeah, I have a special relationship with that one. I mean, I'm long it, and I don't really believe it, but it's fine. Bitcoin being, and it's just to me, it's just a commodity. Yeah, so I price it just like any commodity. It's got the same it's got the highest volatility characteristics in the history of anything that I've ever traded. So it's got just that's the whole thing. I mean, it for a long time. I mean, if I think of like the worst things that I've tried to risk manage, silver's right at the top of the list. I mean, largely a function of its volatility. I mean, some of these things. So on that one in particular, I'm interested in because you mentioned the mystery buyer in gold, right? It's not a mystery to watch people. Last week, when some major buyer of SLV calls, we're talking like short-term calls, huge orders, right? I mean, and this kind of speaks back to your point, Josh. Maybe take this one on flows that. Okay, copper, there's a supply and there's a demand, but the amount of options contracts that are trading on copper can actually suppress the price. It can perpetuate the price. The short-term nature of the options market has made a lot of things go haywire. I can't see why that wouldn't continue to apply to something like, anything, commodities, never mind silver.
Hi, Robert McGrory here. Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for a deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager-in-chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40-plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high-conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Yeah, so I was down at the Boca, FIA, the Futures Industry Association, annual meetings down in Boca. We are one of the newest members of the Global Clearinghouse community. I haven't launched. That's within weeks. there was a lot of talk and a lot of preparation for more more movements of retail into futures markets. That is, you know, definitely a bit, you know, at the same time, you know, there's a lot of talk of new regulations of lowering the leverage and raising the capital requirements. Regulators and sort of market infrastructure players are very big on the radar of, you know, what retail flows are doing in options markets.
Yeah, there's plenty of gambling going on, but there's plenty of manipulation. I mean, there are plenty of, I can think of one city in particular through the pipe of Chicago where I see it, what's going on in Spy Monkey ODTE options, and now they're flowing into, they were doing weeklies with Tesla, now they're doing SLV weeklies, SLV monthlies. It's just, it's not going away because there's just so much money to be made there. Especially if you can bully the market with like a big call options, order. So I think that's fun. It's not for the faint of heart, right, guys? I mean, these things aren't. This is, like you said, it's not like trading TLT or something like that.
Yeah.
No, hopefully, it doesn't scare people. But the way that I roll is like I try to, you know, use the lessons of Stan Druckenmiller. Like when something big, like a commodity cycle, really starts to break out, you spread your wings, right? So, like recently, we were talking about cocoa because it's just crazy, but lumber, you know, there are plenty of things that I've been adding. Is there anything else there, Jeff, that you said copper's number one for you? Is there anything there that you're just like, okay, this is obvious and it hasn't moved yet? I was trying to ask about nickel with Mackenzie Davis, and he's like, well, he coached me and coached me through the Indonesian dynamic, which I didn't know. I don't know a lot of things, but any other things that are, you know, piquing your interest?
Oil, and more oil. I mean, that thing is a tinderbox.
I'm going lumber, and you just come back to oil. It's like okay.
Oh, I mean, wait. Everybody goes, they point to all this spare production capacity. Two things on that. One, obviously, most of it all resides inside two countries, Saudi Arabia and UAE, which are, they're the OPEC cartel that has more market power today than at any other point in time in the history of the cartel going back to 1960. And people go, oh, well, they'll chase the market higher. By the way, there's no history of them chasing the market higher at this point in the business cycle. You know, when you show right. that picture of the rebound, never in the existence of OPEC have they tamed that price spike going into that second phase of the business cycle. Whether they want, I don't want to go into motivation, whether they wanted to or not to, but the fact of the matter is there's no evidence. Everybody goes, oh, I don't want to be long oil because they're going to cap it. Well, there's no evidence at this point in the business cycle that they ever cap it, which, by the way, is not good news for the central banks around the world. but can you take them out of the picture? Demand is strong. Inventories are low. Capacity outside of those two countries is severely constrained, so bad in places like Mexico that they're canceling the exports because they got to keep it internally, cap that with a fire in Cantrell. I can go around the world with a different supply. And now we haven't even priced in the potential for a geopolitical disruption somewhere in the world, given all of everything that is happening in the current environment. The way I like to describe it, oil is probably going to give you better returns than copper in the long run, but it's going to be a painful, bumpy ride. Copper is probably a better sharp ratio trade than oil just because it's not going to have the same volatility. But in no way am I taking oil out of the race. You know, everybody thought, oh, it could go maybe this year, and look where it is right now.
Well, like, I learned what not to do with my economics degree. Yeah, so one professor I had taught me something that you can do with markets, which is long-term cyclical mean reversions, which was Bob Shiller's class on that. So it's pretty amazing, right? You just pull back the chart more than, you know, 3 months, and you might actually see something if you go to 3, 5, 25, 50 years. And, if you look at it that way, I mean, all it really needs to do, WTI, is blast through that like 94 level, and then all of a sudden you got the post-pandemic 122, 125 in range, and then I think you got to go back to 08, right? 147. I'm talking about TI. Like, what? Where are do you? Like, I don't actually have price targets. I have mean reversion zones. Like, I just outline them. Like, how do you explain the upside? Like, do you have a spot where you think it could actually go?
By the way, the core problem, and you know, I know you've been talking about the on this show probably, Matt, is that the world cannot hold a position. It won't trade. It trend follows.
Right.
So once you see this space start creating a trend, and I don't mean just oil, I mean the entire commodity complex, the equities on the commodity side, the whole old economy, the potential for this thing to really overprice. You know, we saw it with whether it was Einhorn out talking about the passive ETFs and everything it's doing to, you know, the overvaluation of the tech stocks. That dynamic can work in this space as well. You know, because I give you an example of a meeting I had recently with a company that's flushed with cash, great story, fundamentals playing out. And I go, why aren't you guys buying it? Well, it doesn't work. Well, the fundamentals are working, but the stock price is not working. And they go, we'll just buy tech. And they go, they're unwilling to hold the position and wait for this to occur. And by the way, when it occurs, it's going to pop. It's going to go rather quickly. And I think, you know, that's a core problem is how transient global money is across the space.
Yeah.
And I think there's a bigger, and I think, you know, Einhorn blamed it all on the passive ETFs and commodities, it's the CTAs, you know, they all that, the trend followers. But I think the real core problem here goes back to a much bigger issue is liquidity is down across all these markets. So these trend followers can dominate the trends. But the bottom line, to answer your question, once this thing gets going, I don't know how to handicap it.
Yeah, yeah.
All I know is probably going to be really vicious to the upside.
Well, you know what's interesting, Jeff? I mean, at least by my scorecard, because again, I look at the entire waterfront every morning. In the last 3 months, that game has changed and not immaterially, right? If you look across asset classes, the ways to bet on inflation aren't just straight up CRB index up 15%, oil up 28%, but it's bond yields, duration straight down. It's at the equity sector level. Energy has now become the number one performing on GICS level one sector styles. That took over. Yesterday, during the shit show that the U.S. stock market had, XLE was up again. You know, it's basically Exxon and Chevron, but I mean, our analyst likes those too. But the it's on. Like, you're either going to read and react and accept that inflation is higher for longer and potentially going a lot higher, or you're going to underperform. And I mean, across asset classes, that's a major issue. I don't know how this wouldn't be obvious to anybody actually at this point.
Yep.
Apple, which is the opposite of that, or Tesla. We have our analyst, Fernando Valle, you might know him. Used to be a long time at Citigroup, a Brazilian guy. Love that guy. He's like, he created this hashtag XOM over Elon. And man, did we get a lot of fans for that, right, Josh?
Oh, yeah. I bet he did.
But just look at it. I mean, you know, the terrible twos aren't just like how our kids used to be. It's Apple and Tesla. And there is a shit ton of market cap to give up to Exxon.
Yeah.
I'm not just talking Exxon, you know. Like,
they always give it up to Exxon. You know, it's, yeah. The 30 years I've been doing this, the two go like this. And I'm pretty sure Exxon's going to regain a lot of it. In fact, I actually had the numbers ran the other day. Cash generated by Exxon and Pioneer together last year was $60 billion. Ooh. Only Apple beat it at $97 billion. The average for the Magnificent Seven was $47 billion. So Exxon's printing more cash than the Magnificent Seven.
There you go. That's something else I didn't know. How about on, maybe we're running out of time here, Josh, but just because I went there, as soon as we go hashtag XOM over Elon, we're like, okay, now you're going to compete with Chinese EVs that sell at what?
Yeah, look, I think Jeff mentioned earlier in the show, I think it's underappreciated the rotation of, you know, call it 8% growth, you know, really driven by, you know, kind of more basic heavy industry in China and real estate, you know, over the last cycle. And the way that's been channeled to, you know, maybe it's a little bit lower, sort of 5% growth. But the sectors and the export, you know, markets that are being driven now in the Chinese investment cycle into EVs, battery metals, you know, yep. Solar, It's a very, I think it's a higher quality growth, and they're really just dominating those supply chains, you know, to the point where, you know, you've got headlines a few years ago of, you know, China needs to be cleaner, and now it's, you know, China needs to, you know, stop flooding the market with, you know, with green exports. So it is quite important, and I think a lot of these phase transitions and shifts get missed, particularly when they compound at the rate. Yeah. That China's investing, you know, and of course, you know, at ABEX, you know, we've been focused on the battery raw materials and listing new futures contracts, you know, developing new futures contracts, because we think, you know, again, the growth of you know, the battery raw materials, you know, this is, you know, we're in the early innings of this.
Very early. I mean, anybody that's in that business from a manufacturing perspective, production, anyone I know, it's like, dude, it's like, you know, inning one, two, let's like, so congrats, by the way, we're out of time, but congrats on what you've built, like, Josh, on that front. And now you got, to have you two together, is, like I said, it's like the OG, we got the band back, and it's, but what you're doing is just like, I mean, it took a lot of, I could use different words, but it took a lot of courage. Let's use a nice word, to do what you're doing. I mean, to be, you know, doing kilo contracts in Asia, that's awesome. I love that. That's capitalism, and we need more capitalists out there. So you guys are obviously that. And I just want to thank you for doing it together. We should do this again sometime.
All right. Thanks, Keith.
Appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeff.
Look, there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of ways to skin the cat, right? There's a lot of ways to think about every asset class. What we try to do is, again, invite dissenting opinions, complimenting opinions. You know, hopefully I'm not in a political debate. That's not my bag, and I'm not political. But again, what we're trying to do is help you understand how we use our process and other sources to augment conviction that is signaling in the process, okay? So hopefully in the last 3 days you got that. You got a lot more. I'm very fortunate and thankful to have everyone that's been on with me. There are nine what we call real conversations, and I said I was looking for more of an education and learn a lot, and I certainly did. I hope you did too. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the Hedgeye Investing Summit, featuring conversations with some of the sharpest minds in investing. To get access to the other 8 Hedgeye Investing Summit conversations and for more great investing content, go to Hedgeye.com. Don't forget to check out Hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @Hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.